Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
In a world of endless notifications, there could be an important one you're missing. Your kidneys may be signaling an SOS. With high blood pressure or type 2 diabetes, your kidneys could be warning you of early signs of damage, which may put you at higher risk for events like heart attack or stroke. But there's a simple test that can help spot a hidden signal. Ask your doctor about a urine test called UACR to help detect kidney disease and heart risk early. To learn more, visit detectthesos.com today.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Langwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. As we do each week, I'd like to begin our program with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. Peter, John, Andrew, and Malachi sat close to a brightly burning fire that gave off much warmth. Jesus was nowhere to be seen, and the disciples were concerned. Time was passing quickly, and nightfall was upon them. "We must make the fire even brighter," Peter exclaimed as he gathered more twigs to throw on it, "so that the Master will be able to find us and not get lost." John said, "Peter, who is the lost one, we or the Master? I feel somehow he will find his way to us." The men began to laugh. It was good that they did, because it helped to alleviate the concern all of them felt. Malachi was a friend of Judas and came from the same town. He was pleased to spend time with Judas's friends. He said, "I anxiously await your master, for I have heard so much about him." The men acknowledged what he said. Malachi continued, "I understand that he is well-liked now." Peter interjected, "And he shall be forever." Slowly, out of the darkness, Jesus came and approached the men. "Oh, you have seen the fire," Peter exclaimed. Jesus smiled and said, "Thank you. I knew you would be concerned about me, and so I hurried back." Malachi said, "I have many questions to ask you." Peter tried to push him aside and said, "Please let the master rest. I'm sure he is tired." "No," Jesus responded, "not tired of body, but of mind." Malachi said, "Master, how important is time in our life?" The men looked at one another, wondering why he would ask such a strange question. Jesus answered, "Time? What shall I say about time? The time of birth, the time of death, and the time in between are opportunities to learn. We come into this world with nothing, and when we leave it, we leave much behind. Hopes, dreams, knowledge." The men looked at one another again because they didn't understand what Jesus was saying. But he continued, "All of us are teachers, whether we realize it or not. as a mother holds her child warmly and tenderly. She teaches that child how important love is in caring for one another, sharing with one another, dreaming with one another, working with one another as we go through life together. Time is a gift which enables us to learn, to share, to grow. But the time will come when, like the maiden with the lamp whose oil has burnt out and can no longer provide any, light goes out. Still one leaves a memory, a thought, or a dream, both good and bad. Malachi thought for a moment and then said, "Time should be recorded." Jesus replied, "It is, my friend. It is in the book of life in my Father's home." A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes in the introduction to his latest book titled Carpe Diem, Redeemed, Seizing the Day, Discerning the Times. And again, as he writes, "If, as people commonly say today, our brief lives are simply the dash, quote, the dash between two dates on our gravestones, close quote, what hope is there of investing that brief dash with significance? There are truths that no one can answer for us. We must face them alone. Our own mortality is one of them. How challenging to stand and ask, as Tolstoy asked himself, what will come of my entire life? Is there any meaning in my life that will not be annihilated by the inevitability of death which awaits me? And how terrible, close to the end of life, and have to say with Tolstoy's Ivan Ilyich, what if my whole life has been wrong?" In short, our human challenge is to make the most of our time on earth and to know how to do it. Time and space are the warp and woof of the reality in which we live our brief lives as humans, but they are different. When Alexander the Great asked Diogenes if there was anything he could do for him, the flinty old philosopher answered famously, "Stand out of my light." We can occupy part of space exclusively and block someone else's access. But no one occupies time exclusively. Time is our commons, the open and shared ground for all who are alive at any moment to enjoy together. More importantly, we humans can conquer space, and we do so easily and routinely with our bulldozers, our cranes, our smartphones, our jets, and all the shiny achievements of our technological civilization. But we cannot conquer time. Time does not lie still before us like space, for it is within us as well as around us, and it is never stationary. It moves in one direction only, onwards and unstoppable. In the words of Abraham Joshua Heschel, philosopher and rabbi, quote, "Man transcends space and time transcends man," close quote. Importantly, too, the comparative ease of our conquest of the world of physical space distinguishes a vital fact. Our conquests of space are always at the expense of using up time. We are spending our time, even if we twiddle our thumbs and do nothing. And energetic activism does not solve the problem. We can build bigger and bigger barns or bigger and bigger empires, whether political or commercial, but there is always a day or a night when life ends. And then, as Jesus of Nazareth warned, quote, "Your soul is required of you," close quote, which means that the time we have spent in doing anything is the real cost and the proper key to assessing whether we have gained or lost and the effort has been worthwhile. However effortless seeming our accomplishments, we always pay for them at the expense of our greatest challenge in the most insoluble mystery of our lives, time. Quote from the Gospel of Mark, "What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul?" These beautiful words are the words of Os Guinness, PhD, our guest this evening. He was born in China, educated in England, the author of more than 30 books, including The Call Renaissance, Fool's Talk, Impossible People, and Last Call for Liberty, which we discussed with him the last time he was here this past December. He has been a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and a senior fellow at the East-West Institute. A frequent speaker and prominent social critic, he has addressed audiences worldwide. A passionate advocate of freedom of religion and conscience for people of all faiths and none, he was the lead drafter for both the Williamsburg Charter and the Global Charter of Conscience, and he lives with his wife, Jenny, in the Washington, D.C. area. Os Guinness, how great to have you back again.
Well, the joy is mine. Thank you for having me back.
I love when a book comes out. It's like a social commentary. It's like you have this great insight. It's not. It's more than an intuition. It's almost like a revelation to me from the God that enables us to see, you know, what really is happening in life and how we need to look at it. And you help us to do so with from the right perspective. And you tell us a little bit about yourself in the book. And you indicate that you're like a dog with oversensitive ears, that you've always felt the presence and passing of time acutely. And you spent a lot of time thinking about time. And so this is a gift to all of us. You indicate that it's one of the major themes in your life. And so we benefit from this book, so well thought out and explained. And I mentioned to Os on the phone, I discovered through the book, because he said he was born in 1941, makes me 1 year older than he is. So we lived in the same historical period, not the same place. But together today, we can proclaim the ancient Jewish prayer, "Privileged, O Lord, are we to live in this generation." And that's a close quote, and this book is definitely founded in hope. It was fascinating to me that some books begin with one or a few quotations at the beginning of their book, but you begin with 99 on 14 pages, and that's quite a start. Now, a lot of them show up, a good many of them show up during the course of the book. Why did you begin with so many reflections on the concept of time?
Well, I'm interested that you counted them. That's amazing. Well, you know, I had them, and I was going to just choose three or four maybe for the front of the book, as you said many books do. But then I showed them to a friend, and he said, you know, just reflect on these, ponder these, and you have the whole challenge of time in a few pages.
Yes.
So I'm sure some people will not read my book itself. They'll just look through the quotations. But some are very deep, some are challenging, some are funny. But you really do have in 14 pages, you know, a huge part of the human wisdom about time.
And a huge part of the wisdom that you reflect in this book. I would need to say, as I read through, I began at one point to start checking them off and to cross-reference to see if indeed they were in the front of the book. Tell us a little bit about your philosophy, you only live once, the popularized version of the famous Epicurus maxim, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die.
Well, that's not mine, but I saw that as I start the book. I saw that as graffiti on one of the walls.
Oh, yes.
Coming into St. Pancras Station in London when I was on the Eurostar. You only live once, and it doesn't last. So live it up, drink it down, laugh it off, burn it at both ends. You can't take it with you. You only live once. You know, as you said, that's a somewhat distorted version of Epicurus, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And it was the so-called YOLO philosophy. But many of those who subscribed to it forgot that the original version had a sting in its tail. You only live once, if then.
Yes.
In other words, life is incredibly short and fragile and vulnerable, and many people don't make the most of life. They simply don't live wisely because they forget how short life is. You know, I wrote the book because a couple of years ago I was in home in Oxford, and I read a book on Carpe Diem by an atheist philosopher from Australia. And it was actually a lot of fun, the book. But I realized all he had was the secular view of life. And I thought, my word, he doesn't understand the difference from the Eastern view And he certainly doesn't understand the Jewish and Christian biblical view, which are far deeper and richer. So I thought I'd write, it's not specifically a reply, but I wanted to put out the Jewish and Christian view of time. Because, you know, I believe, Father, that we're in a time when the foundations are giving way in the West. And we need to relay many of the simple, solid foundations by which people can live every day. And one of them is this biblical view of time and history. You know, some of the others, a biblical view of human dignity, of freedom, of justice, and so on. But this one I wanted to do on time. So that's what was behind the book.
And of course, the Bible tells us, you are dust, and to dust you will return, that one day a single breath will be our last. And I've been there when a couple of people that I love deeply in my family, I was there for their last breath. Such a dramatic, dramatic moment. And we live with the thought that the day will come when it will be as if we had never been here at all. Not for most of us and those we've loved, but we do pass so quickly. As we look at people we've worked with, even lived with, and say, oh, yeah, you remember what's his name? And so what is it? Why aren't we at the center of our existence? You raise that question in your book.
Well, you know, the psychologists often say there are two important moments for us in life, in a way I wish I'd put this in the book. But the first is the moment we say, I am I. In other words, we're born with an incredible sense of oneness with our mother and then with our parents and our siblings and so on. And then we grow up, the psychologists call it individuation. We grow up and realize, you know, I am I and you are you and we're all separate individuals. And that's very important. Some people have a fear of separation anxiety, and they never really live. Other people have an overdeveloped sense, I am I and who but I? You know, and you have the narcissist running around in the world. The second moment is the one that you read a little line about earlier. I am an I, and I won't be here forever. In other words, we face our mortality, and we realize the time will come when the memory of us won't be on the earth, except for a tiny handful of us. And again, some people just try and deny that and live their lives as if they're immortality projects, like, say, the pharaohs and their pyramids and so on. And yet we've all got to come to terms with the fact life is short, life is fragile, life is vulnerable. How do we make the most of it? That's what is behind my book, helping people to really understand how they can make the most of it.
As you write, look around the world today at all our high striding billionaires, multi-billionaires, and soon to be trillionaires. They may be titans of finance or technology or political power, but face to face with time, they are the same little people, the same mortals we all are. Whatever their plans and their dreams for the future, whatever their intentions and their resolutions, whatever their energy and their resources, death awaits for them at the end, as for us all. And death is therefore truly humanity's final enemy. Whatever the hopes of the life extension dreamers, heroes or villains, saints or sinners, world famous or unknown, we all die in the end. All human life is time bound. It always has been, and it always will be. Our basic condition is what the novelist and poet Thomas Hardy called time torn. And so the question that is arised, and I'm not going to ask it of you now because we just have some 30 seconds until we need to take our first break. The question that we have to ask is, how then are we to understand our existence on Earth, no matter how long or how short it may be? And given the world in which we live in today, we have to ask ourselves, are we becoming slaves to the technology that we have created? A lot of people are writing about that even now. So we're going to take this break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Os Guinness about his latest book, Seizing the Day, Discerning the Times, Carpe Diem, Redeemed. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest, special guest, is Os Guinness. His latest book is titled Carpe Diem, Redeemed, subtitled Seizing the Day, Discerning the Times. One of the issues that he raises in his book is the human challenge to make the most of our time on earth and to know how to do it. And what comes to my mind is the day after Thanksgiving for the third year in a row, there's a group called Amen to Action. They're going to come together at the convention center downtown Pittsburgh beginning at 8 o'clock, and they're going to put together food for the hungry. They want to exceed the past 2 years and pack over 1 million meals for Pittsburgh's hungry and less fortunate. And the million mark was 1,036,111 last year. So if you'd like to know more about that, more details to volunteer, you can go to the website Amen to Action. Os, that point that you make, that our human challenge is to make the most of our time on earth and to know how to do it. How do we come to understand it and know what it is that we can do?
Well, you know, a huge part is understanding the differences between the different philosophies of time. So if we go to the Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, the New Age, time is cyclical. And obviously that notion of cycle is partly in nature. We're now, you know, in the autumn and winter's coming, and then spring and summer and so on, and our own lives. We're born, we mature, we decline, we die. And you can see that there is a cycle in the universe, but what the Eastern religions do is project that cycle, which we can observe, onto the very cosmos and existence itself, and the whole notion of reincarnation. And you can see that life goes round and round and round, and history eventually goes nowhere. And then on the other hand, you have the secularist view, which is really tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. It's the succession of moments, and there's no meaning in time whatever. So if you want meaning, you add it. You create it yourself. And obviously there are optimists who believe that humans can make history better and better and better and better, Steven Pinker and people like that. And then you've got the pessimists who say there's no meaning in time, and we're really rather like Sisyphus rolling a stone up the hill that rolls all the way down again. There's a futility to the idea that we can impose meaning on time. Now, when you see the contrast of the East on the one hand and then the atheist secularist view on the other, the biblical view, I love the little phrase, yes, contrast is the mother of clarity, because you see the difference it makes for a biblical Jewish and Christian view of time, where time is meaningful and history is going somewhere. It's not a tale told by an idiot, as Hamlet says. It has real meaning, and there's all sorts of elements that flow out of that. And thank God that although we live this short life, the Christian Jewish view just makes it rich.
Are we then becoming slaves to the technology that we have created? So much discussion about that today.
Well, we are in many ways. In other words, we've created a tool which becomes our master. So you take time. Here we are in the 21st century. We're living in the world of fast life, 24/7, 365 pressure. You know, you can think, it comes from clock time with its precision. You know, I love the Kenyan saying, all Westerners have watches, Africans have time.
Yes.
Or Filipinos' friends have said, you know, Westerners are people with a god on their wrists, so we have to say now, in our hands with mobile phones. So you take one look at your watch and you roar off, got to go. And we are driven people because we're living in this world of fast life, and the wonderful technology of watches and clocks has just left us prisoners in many ways.
But we're never going to conquer time, are we? It's
never.
Futile to try to do that.
Never. And you can see, you know, the longing for immortality and the search for cryonics or life extension, or, you know, Silicon Valley billionaires who get themselves injected with the blood of 20-year-olds every year to try and delay the aging process. You know, at the end of the day, they simply won't do it. And the only way people are talking about, you know, downloading your brains and things like this, Ted Williams is frozen. His head is somewhere out there in Silicon Valley, frozen. You know, all that's left is technology. But we are people who feel and touch and taste and see and enjoy a glass of wine or make love. And that's simply impossible with all they're talking about with cryonics. So I think we've got to come to terms with the fact we may delay life a little, live to 110, 120, but the idea we'll be around for 10,000 years and so on, I think is absolute nonsense.
And science, by its very nature, you write, can give us explanations for things, but it cannot provide the meaning we're asking for, can it? I mean, we need to pay attention to science, but it should not override what the Bible teaches us.
Oh, exactly. I mean, science is wonderful, and none of us should ever be against science. But all that science does is introduce us to the how of things. What science cannot do is tell us about the why of things. In other words, the meaning, the purpose. And of course, that's what the Bible does. And at the end of the day, it's meaning and purpose and belonging that we need, not just an advance in the how of things. So science is magnificent, but we can't trust in science to do more than science can do.
And to bring in some of the religious figures in your book, Abraham Joshua Heschel said that man transcends space. We're beginning to understand that more and more as science uncovers more and more. Man transcends space, but time transcends mind. And Jesus says, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? And so throughout the book, you bring the Bible and its wisdom into it, don't you?
Well, the Bible is the deepest, richest, most profound book on human wisdom. I mean, God's wisdom shared with us. I mean, the verse you just read was incredibly important for my wife in her journey of faith. She was an atheist and a fashion model in New York, doing extremely well, and front cover of Vogue many times. But as she was thinking about the meaning of life, you know, she went into her mother's bedroom when her mother was with her, and her mother just happened to have a Bible there, and she just flipped it open, wondering what verse might pop out randomly, and that's the verse she saw. What does it profit a person if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? And she realized she'd made an incredible success of her life. She was engaged to a multimillionaire French baron, front cover of Vogue and all that sort of stuff. But what is that up to? And that's what made her really start thinking about life in a far deeper way and spurred her on her search. You know, Socrates says the unexamined life is not worth living. And if he's right, you know, there are millions of people in America and the West today who are leading lives not worth living by Socrates' standards because they've never thought enough and cared enough, deeply enough, to wonder what the meaning of life is. And you cannot find it through science. You can't find it through technology. You can't find it through market economics. And that's why the wonder of the Bible, we've got to get beyond these other things that can make life so prosperous and convenient and comfortable on many levels. But meaning and purpose and identity, they have to come through knowing God, and that's a deeper question.
In fact, the wisdom of the ages, you point out, still holds true, that we must look to ultimate beliefs.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I mean, I can think, you know, when I was a student, people were still thinking that art could lead the way forward. But you think how art over the last century has lost its way. Well, people thought about philosophy. Well, philosophy is simply good thinking about thinking. And if you look back over 3,000 years of philosophy, for all its clarification of how we think and that sort of thing, it hasn't given us any real answers to the profound meaning of life, and hasn't actually reached any conclusions on which all philosophers agree. So at the end of the day, you're thrown back again on ultimate beliefs, whether they're religious, like the Christian faith and Judaism, or whether they're more secular, like atheism and agnosticism. But you're back to ultimate beliefs, because they alone do justice to the deepest questions of life.
In fact, you write, in short, seizing the day, making the most of life, and understanding the meaning of life are inseparable. All three require that if we are to master time, we must come to know the author of time, the meaning of time, and come to know the part he calls us to play in his grand story, which makes the deepest overall sense of time and history. Even more, wonder of wonders, we are then invited to live lives that align our individual hopes and destinies with the very purpose and destiny of the universe itself. And so many people are looking for purpose today, but they're looking in the wrong places for it. At least I would think.
Oh, exactly. I used to work with a lot of CEOs, and it's amazing how many times you hear them saying, I climbed the ladder of success and found it was up against the wrong wall. Think of the Tolstoy quotes that you read earlier. Or think, Father, of the way there's a huge difference between our resume self and our eulogy self, as David Brooks puts it. You think of the story, say, of Alfred Nobel behind the Peace Prizes and so on. You know, when he was in South Africa in 1888, he was horrified one morning to read his own obituary. You know, the gunpowder king, the man who has found more ways of killing people faster and making himself rich than anyone else in history, has died. Now, in fact, it was his brother Ludwig who died. But when he read what the world thought of him and his fortune through making gunpowder, he was horrified. And he spent the remaining years of his life trying to do something better and left more than 95% of his money to the prizes we now know as the Nobel Prizes.
Mm-hmm.
And many people have got to stop and think, you know, who are we? What does life add up to? And really assess their lives in the light of the simple reality we're all going to die. That's back to Tolstoy. You know, what meaning is there in my life when we're faced with the automatic inevitability of death? And that should make us think, not to be gloomy, but to make us think of how we make the most of our lives.
You point out that we humans are so immersed in time that we will never be able to see and understand time objectively. And then you make a comparison, not a direct comparison, but along with evil, you write, along with evil, time is one of the greatest mysteries in human life. Do you see any relationship between time and evil?
Well, it's just the fact that they're both mysteries. We will never get to the bottom of the mystery of evil. And we'll probably never get to the bottom of the mystery of time. And you can see it today in science. One of the big mysteries is, what on earth is consciousness? And so on. In other words, mystery should make us humble. And there's an arrogance in modern rationalism. We can know everything. Our pundits can tell us what's going to happen next year and all this sort of stuff. We need to recover humility, and certainly humility in the face of time.
I have never heard the observation before, and that time is nature's way to keep everything from happening at once. Seems to be so much wisdom captured there. Time is nature's way to keep everything from happening at once. And that was written on a stall somewhere, wasn't it? I mean, it was from the mouth of some
came
great
from the men's bathroom in a cafe in Austin, Texas. You know, and people first thought that was incredibly profound. But of course we don't understand time, so anything like that sounds profound. You know, I love, you know, too, the great saying by St. Augustine. When people didn't ask him about time, it was perfectly clear in his mind, and he could well explain it to them. But as soon as someone actually asked him to put it in words what time was, he was stuck. Time's a mystery.
You write that the three major families of faiths are the Eastern, the Abrahamic, and the secularist, and out of them have grown three dominant and very different views of time and history, the cyclical, the covenantal, and the chronological. Let's see how much we can talk about before our next break about the differences between these three. Say a little bit, first of all, about the cyclical concept of time.
Well, the important thing is to see that while some people are sloppy thinkers, and they say, basically, everyone really agrees, so we're just putting in different words, or there are different ways up the mountain and this sort of stuff. There are huge differences, and the differences make a difference. So if you take time as a wheel, it's driven by desire, which leads to craving, which leads to attachment, and you're bound to the wheel of life, which goes round and round. Hindus, some say 18,000 times, some say a million. The goal is to escape from the wheel. But the key thing is history goes nowhere, and there's no high place for the individual, because freedom is not freedom to be an individual, it's freedom from individuality, because being an individual is being caught on this world of illusion or maya. And you can see that people who choose the Eastern way, they have to face the consequences. Science could never have come out of the East. Human rights could never have come out of the East. And you can see that it is based on observations. As I said, there are cycles in life, nature. But when you project them onto the universe itself, it gives you a very poor view of history and yes. of time.
The second type is the covenantal time.
Well, I love that. That's the Jewish and Christian view. In other words, over the whole of history is a personal, infinite God and his providence. So under God, we come to know him and trust him and obey him, and then we join him in his purposes in history. You know that wonderful verse in Acts 13 where the Apostle Paul is describing King David, and he says, David, after he'd served God's purpose in his own generation, fell asleep. That's the covenantal view. God is overarching history. We come to know God. We act into history under God. And we're invited to be his partners in the repair and the restoration of the world. And you have this incredibly meaningful view of time. There's nothing like it mm-hmm. in the other two families of faiths.
And to amplify on that with reading from your book titled Carpe Diem, Redeemed, we are not a freak accident lost, and again, talking about the covenantal time, we are not a freak accident lost in the universe that came to be without meaning, one day will cease to be without meaning. History has a purpose, and humanity a destiny. And other, a little further on, you write, God is personally and passionately engaged with his creation and on behalf of his creation, and especially committed to and concerned for the human creatures he has made in his image and likeness. God loves us and believes in us as humans even more than we love and believe in ourselves. And so as creator of time as well as space, God is out time. God is personal, therefore engaged in history with humanity. He alone is sovereign and therefore absolutely free to express and execute his will without restraint or interference. We have just a couple minutes. Say a little bit then about the third form of time.
Well, the secularist view of time is basically the biblical, the Jewish and Christian view, shorn of God, shorn of transcendence. So all you have is not this covenantal view of time. It's the chronological view. It's just purely tick-tock, 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 the succession of the moments without any meaning. So if you want meaning in time, you have to make it yourself and impose it on time. Now, in the 18th century, with the rise of secular progressivism, they tried to replace revelation with reason and providence with progress. And people thought that was going to work, and humanity could redeem history by its own power. But you think of the 20th century and war and genocide, disaster. There are far fewer optimists in that sense than there were in the 18th century. And so you see that the third view is split between the optimists, people like Steven Pinker, the world's getting better and better, and then the pessimists who see that time is running away with us, alienating us. You think of Samuel Beckett, Waiting for Godot, or his extraordinary last, one of his last plays called Crap's Last Tape, where a 69-year-old man is listening to tape recordings of himself when he was 29, 39, I think, and he's not the same person. Time has just shattered him in fragments, and you have a very negative view of time.
Yes. Let me read us out to our break. You write, sooner or later, the choice between these views of time will suddenly loom large for each of us and become a matter of life and death. Do we at that point stick to the secular and chronological road to nowhere? Or do we turn off to the Eastern path and renounce this ever-circling world as an illusion from which we must escape? Or do we turn back to the biblical view of covenantal time, through which both history and our human freedom gain a peerless significance? Contrast is the mother of clarity. Entire worlds and ways of life grow out of each view. Time, history, meaning, significance, and the character of civilizations are all at stake in the view we choose and the view of the world we live within. Welcome back to the second hour of Amplify, where our guest is Os Guinness, talking about his latest book, Carpe Diem Redeemed. He is the author of more than 30 books. He is a frequent speaker and prominent social critic who has addressed audiences worldwide and is a passionate advocate of freedom of religion and conscience for people of all faiths and no faiths. Austin, the second chapter of your book is titled Survival of the Fastest, and you indicate that the clock is the most powerful and consequential invention of the Western world. And you outline then three features of modern clock time: precision, coordination, and pressure. Tell us a little bit about those three features.
Well, we're living in the world of fast life, which means that time is not just we're talking about something philosophically or theoretically, but we're living under incredible pressure. Precision is pretty obvious if you think about it. You think people have always measured time, but you take the name afternoon. Well, that's a very broad time. The sun was at its highest at noon, and you've got the long afternoon. Or you take, say, sundials. They're terrific if you live in Italy or Greece where there's lots of sun. But what happens if you live in the winter in Norway or Scotland? You know, there's no sun to judge it by. You can think of all the early ways of measuring time. An hourglass, turn it over exactly as the last grain of sand goes through, and you're in business. But if it's not made well or you miss it, you're out again. Whereas the modern watch and clock with seconds and now atomic, you know, when I was writing that, I went up to our local watch shop and they were advertising an atomic clock that would only be off by 1 second in a billion years. You know, that's the pressure of the precision of modern times. So, you know, you take your great American explorers, Lewis and Clark. They agreed to meet on a certain day at a certain place, and in the end, they were 9 days apart. But they record that in their journal as being, quote, relatively punctual.
Yes.
Imagine docking a space station 9 days apart. You'd be dead.
Yes.
So you can think of our modern time, and that's part of its huge pressure, is this incredible precision.
And then the second one is coordination. Or no, the second one is...
Yeah, no, it's coordination.
Oh, it is coordination. Yes, okay, yes.
Yeah. I mean, you think in the old days, you could be in a village close to a town, and you'd have a different set of time in the two different places. But it was in the 19th century when clocks spread, and particularly trains and railway timetables and little puffing trains crossing continents, and suddenly everyone was going by the same time in the same time zone. And so there's an extraordinary coordination. There's a story of the French Minister of Education And he'd look at his watch and he'd say, whatever the subject was, knowing that every school child in France was studying the same topic at the same time. Now, that sort of coordination was quite new. And it adds again to the extraordinary pressure we're living under in terms of time.
And then the third, of course, is pressure, where you write that today, time is big money and scarce money. So we buy time, maximize time, and we make sure that we are having quality time. We figure out the opportunity costs of all we do, and we become adept at multitasking, that in such a world, efficiency is a supreme virtue, and seconds are the currency of modern life. A little more that you'd like to add to this.
Well, no, you get the point there. But Henry Ford is supposed to have said, I give my workers every second they need, but not an extra second. Now, is he being kind or cruel?
Yes.
You can see there efficiency and time and motion studies. And people are really driven. And the ability to just stop, you know, has simply gone.
You write then about the hidden tyranny of time. And here you have the first deeper power of our modern view of time is the power to label and thus to define and shape reality. And then the second hidden consequence of modern time is presumption. And the third tyranny in our modern world of time is paradox. Amplify on those three points, please.
The first one's really the main one.
Okay.
You know, in the old days, a lot of things were described in terms of space. Civilization, those who are within the pale, we are civilized, the Greeks say, and those beyond the pale are the barbarians. Or you can think of the old meaning of the word progress was spatial. Pilgrim's progress meant a journey, or the royal progress meant a king's procession down a road or whatever. But now progress is described temporally in terms of time. You know, we're up to date and everyone behind us is out of date and so on. And you can think of the power of this, because in our world, take the notion of progressivism, either in politics or say in theology, the latest must be greatest. The newer is truer. Well, that's absolute nonsense. That's what Owen Barfield, the friend of C.S. Lewis, called chronological snobbery. Now, the latest may be worse than what you had 50 years ago, but you have to judge it. You have to have a standard by which to assess it. And the idea that because it's change, it must be good, is really incredibly foolish.
And then presumption, the second hidden consequence of modern time, you write, is presumption. Our modern worlds about time have a built-in preference and bias, but the preference is left unstated and the bias unargued.
Well, that's right. You can see this in theology. You know, Dean Ng, the Anglican Dean of St. Paul's a long time ago, said, he who marries the spirit of the age soon becomes a widower. Mm. Because people are always up with the latest fashion or the latest fad. Well, they no sooner cotton on to whatever it is and sound trendy and relevant and up-to-date than the fashion, the fad, has changed, and they're marooned and left high and dry. And you can see that people are just chasing relevance, just become trendy and rather trivial.
And the whole issue then about presumption, you write and that... the lesson, of course, is that we should never be seduced by the mere repetition of words such as values, freedom, progress, and change. The question is, whose values? What is actually meant by freedom? And how progress is defined as the standard by which it is to be judged? The term change can be as deceptive as the term progress. The modern world has such a bias for change that the term often refers only to bare change and even to change for change's sake. But in a world of change, any kind of change is enough to qualify as good and progressive. Progress is change, and change is progress, and that's an end of it. Say a little
bit. You and I can remember the day when, you know, Nikita Khrushchev was in the United Nations and took off his shoe and pounded on the desk and said, "We will bury you."
Yes.
You know, you have today a lot of the progressives say, well, you're on the wrong side of history. Now, how do they know that? You know, Martin Luther King used to quote the 19th century saying that the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And that's right. But as he often said, and he used that above all in a synagogue in L.A., but that's part of the biblical view of time. Under God, things will turn out in the end. The arc of history is bending towards justice. There will be a time when the last tear is wiped away and the last injustice is tackled. But you can't say that in the secularist atheist view, and yet they do. And so they use time to say that those who don't agree with them are backward and on the wrong side of history. But they're actually cheating because they have no way at all of showing that they're on the winning side of time. So we've got to examine a lot of these things and say again and again, the emperor has no clothes.
Yes. The third hidden tyranny in our modern view of time is paradox. Say something, tell us a little bit about paradox.
Well, you know, we're always chasing the isms. And as a wag famously said in England in the 1930s, we're at a moment when all our isms have become wasms. And you can see that many of these things turn out to be the opposite of what people expect, and so on. So, again, there's so many fashionable ways of referring to time. And we've got to challenge to people to be much more critical and self-critical and really examine what they're saying and why they're saying what they're saying.
And you're right, there will always be differences over these ideas and terms, but if advanced modern time is not to be even more tyrannical than it need be, we must each be sure that what we believe and be clear about our aims, our freedom and our humanity are at stake. And so also is our ability to seize the day and make the most of life. Boy, that's a lot that is at stake.
No, absolutely. And so the next chapter is on how people of faith who are following the covenantal, the biblical, the Jewish and Christian view of time can really hope to make the most of it. In other words, the secularist view basically comes down to grab it while you can. Life is very short. There's no meaning ultimately. Just grab it while you can. But that leads to a very short-sighted and selfish view of time. And the biblical view is far richer and deeper than that.
Yeah, you write about the way to seize the day, that the Bible's idea of carpe diem, seize the day, or redeeming the time is sharply different from the direction to which most people take the ideal, toward the selfish, the short term, the purely spontaneous. There is no sure foundation, no stronger propulsion, and no more soaring vision of carpe diem than within the biblical or covenantal view of time. Why you choose, how you choose, and what you choose are all vital and decisive factors in the Bible's understanding. And then I have an asterisk between this part of the book, which means that I wanted to keep coming back to it. Repentance and forgiveness are the key to, quote-unquote, redeeming the time in terms of the past. And notions such as Sabbath and sabbaticals are key to redeeming the time in terms of the present. God calls us in the flux and flow of time and history, and the gift of being able to seize the day flowers from a way of life that weaves together three principles: walk before God, read the signs of times, and serve God's purpose in your generation. And then you amplify on the three of them.
Well, go back to the one you mentioned, and I don't want to pass over that one too fast. You know, people say there's an asymmetry of time. The past is the past, and it's frozen. And the future may be open and free, but not in the biblical view. Often we've done things in the past, and forgiveness is what wipes away the guilt and the burden of it. So forgiveness frees us from the past, and then you have a second chance, and it opens up the future. So forgiveness in the Bible is very closely linked to freedom. And thank God that we can be forgiven for the things of which we're ashamed, or we feel guilty, or we know we're wrong in the past, whether small or great. And forgiveness is an incredibly important part of redeeming the past. Now, how do we do it in the present? Well, you know, I start with walking before the Lord, because if you think of the 10,000-hour principle, say learning to play the piano or a sport or whatever, you practice and practice and practice and practice, 10,000 hours, they say, and there's a discipline to it. So at a certain point, it becomes second nature. It's not first nature, it's second nature, habit. So ingrained, you can do it without thinking. And when someone's mastered, say, the art of piano playing, they're able to improvise spontaneously because they've mastered their discipline. And the same is true of faith. You know, your great saint, St. Francis, does incredibly spontaneous things, but always out of his love for Jesus and his walk of faith. And so it's not just a matter of random acts of kindness or something like that, but it's out of a deeply mature discipleship that knows God and so is free to do the purely spontaneous when it comes. That's the first one, which is often very easily forgotten.
And so we walk before God rather than merely striking out in whatever impromptu acts of faith or whatever unplanned new directions in life may spring to mind. And God is primarily known through his actions in history and in the lives of individuals rather than through arguments alone. And you point out that the reality of God is better demonstrated in the story of the life, work, and death and resurrection of Jesus than in 1,000 arguments about the existence of God. And then the second major requirement for seizing the day, redeeming the time and making the most of life, is discernment of the moment and the hour. That being aware of God, we are also aware of our world and our times, with one hand on the Bible and the other on the newspaper, which is what they tell us about how we should preach. One hand on the Bible and the other on the newspaper now, or the internet today, of course, we are called to read the signs of the times. And then the third principle, God's purpose in our generation, you write, is that God's call is always deeply personal, but it is always a call to the higher and wider purpose of advancing God's rule on life, that life is a gift, so time is always a matter of stewardship. Let me ask you to add to that.
Well, take the second one. The Bible has a rich view of time, day, hour, generation, and the fact we're supposed to be understanding of where things are. So you have that wonderful verse in the book of Chronicles where it says, some of David's followers were skilled in reading the signs of the times to know what course Israel should follow. Or you have the well-known verse about Queen Esther, where her cousin says to her, who knows that you haven't come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And in the Old Testament, most of the examples are very positive. But of course, in the New Testament, especially in the Gospels, they're negative, because our Lord's generation simply didn't get him. Now, as Jesus says, you know how to read the weather, good meteorologists and so on, but you can't read the signs of the times. Mm. And you can see that a lot of people have deep biblical truths of all sorts, but they haven't developed that skill in really trying to understand the times and be able to read them. And that's a very, very important thing to learn. The third one is that we then, with our own individual sense of calling, follow me, with all the gifts God has given each of us, we're then called to bring our callings in line with what we believe are God's purposes in our generation. And that's the covenantal view, that we become partners with God in his covenantal purposes in history, which is what gives life its incredible fulfillment and worthwhileness. I love that.
You also write, we are not omnipotent. And this is talking about the third one, the third principle, God's purpose in our generation. You write, we are not omnipotent or omniscient, so neither our understanding nor our actions will ever be perfect in this life, quote unquote. Imperfect will always be written over our understanding and, quote unquote, incomplete over our actions and our lives. Our best reading of the signs of the times is bound to be flawed. Equally, our best actions will be incomplete. So our true legacy will never be clear until we see God face to face and hear the Master's well done that only He can pronounce. So it seems like we really need to be patient.
Exactly, you put it well. But you know, Father, I've been in, say, business groups where they teach you to figure out, you're over 50, figure out your legacy, what it is you're leaving your daughter or your son, and you've got it all buttoned up. My life has achieved X or Y or Z. I think that's rubbish. We don't know what our lives have contributed. I'm sure you have prayed for people or you've talked in a chance conversation to someone, and maybe you have no clue that was a turning point for them. And so we can't judge what we've done in that sense of incompleteness. You know, all of us have dreams not quite fulfilled in this life because our dreams are bigger than our life is long. You think, say, of Moses. He was called to lead the children of Israel to the promised land. He didn't make it. All he did was see it from the top of Mount Nebo. And for all of us, there's a river we won't cross, and so on. And we got to come to terms with the fact our lives will probably be incomplete. But the great thing is, when we meet the Lord, as it says in Hebrews 11, people who have lived by faith, they've acted into history, but looked over the edge of history and beyond history, God is not ashamed to be the God of those with faith like that, and He's prepared a city for them.
Let me break in there.
The life doesn't have to be complete.
We need to take this break, and we'll be back. Welcome back to Amplify, the last section, segment. We will be ending it about a couple minutes to the hour. Our special guest, I always love to have him on. He has so much to teach us, is Os Guinness, talking about his latest book, Carpe Diem. If you don't understand the language, C-A-R-P-E, Carpe Diem, D-I-E-M, redeem. Or just look up his name on the internet, and you'll list a lot of other books, wonderful things that he has written. Just a final reminder this week that a week from this Friday, on what we call Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, they think in terms of shopping, but over 1 million meals of hope for the hungry are going to be put together that's November 29th at the Convention Center downtown. Doors open at 8. They want to break the record. And if you'd like to make a donation or you want to register for the event, they'd like to have you help, you can call Amen to Action, all one word, and find out so much more about it. Os, we've come towards the end of the book now. Prophetic timeliness is one, and the end is not near. Let me just read from how you begin prophetic untimeliness. I said timeliness. It's untimeliness. The tangled crisis of the Western Church in the modern world bristles with ironies. For a start, the church that is conformed uncritically to the very world that it helped to create is strenuously working to dig its own grave, which means that even in countries such as the United States, where the church still represents a large majority of the people, it has less influence on society than tiny minorities that are a fraction of its size. And as the church staggers around dazed and hurt over its rejection, many Christians add insult to their own injury through their attempts to remain relevant to the modern world in ways that only accelerate their irrelevance. And the point you want to make is the past is certainly the past, but it is far from dead, isn't it?
Well, that's right. And well, take the point about the scandal of the American church. Our Lord calls us to be salt and light. And obviously those are images, pictures of engagement. And you look at the American church where we are now, this is one country in the world where Christians are a huge majority. Unlike, say, most Western European countries where Christians are a tiny minority. And yet if you think tiny groups, take, say, our Jewish friends whom we so deeply admire. They are 2% of America, but they punch well above their weight, intellectually, financially, artistically, in 100 ways. All power to them. And you look at the church, we're a huge majority, and yet we have less influence. You take, say, a group we would often disagree with, like some of the LGBTQ activists. They're a tiny percentage of America, too, but they have much more cultural influence than we do, because we're not as salty and light-bearing as we should be.
And how would you want us to change that?
Well, we've got to see what calling means, and that, you look in history, has been the incredible impact of the church in culture. When every Christian, wherever they are, whether they're doctors or homemakers or architects, politicians, computer scientists or whatever, if they're all being and doing what they should be with the gifts God has given them, I often say the problem in America is not that Christians aren't where they should be. The problem is they're not what they should be right where they are. And so if you took one single thing, and of course no one thing is enough by itself, but if you took one single thing, the recovery of a sense of calling would mean that the Christian church in America would engage the wider culture as salt and light, and the differences would be profound.
And in this chapter, you indicate that there are several places where distortions of time are seriously damaging the life and witness of Christians today, and you focus on three of them that you believe are especially important: the past, the present, and the connection with the future. Let's begin with the past, where distortions of time are damaging the life and witness of Christians today.
To be quite honest, I can't remember what I wrote in that one.
Okay.
I've been into so many things since then.
Right. You point out that there is no daylight at all between the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures and their conviction that memory and history are at the heart of faith, that both Christians and Jews owe their salvation entirely to God, and that in seeking to use the past as an instrument of power, victims remain prisoners of their past and never become free. They become prisoners of their own resentment, and that a people driven by hate or not cannot be free. To be free, you have to let go of hate. And you write that the problem is not that Christians are victims of other people's prejudices. Jesus warned his followers to expect that. The problem is that some Christians are becoming unwitting perpetrators themselves through supportive movements that perpetuate hate.
Well, yes, no, of course, that's a very, very deep discussion you're opening up. Clearly, the most victimized people in history, sadly, have been our Jewish friends. And yet they never portray themselves as victims, because they realize that, going back to Genesis, part of sin and its consequence is ducking responsibility. And you can see that those who portray themselves as victims eventually come to perceive themselves as victims, and then the end is they paralyze themselves as victims. So, you know, people complain about homophobia or Islamophobia, and some people are calling us to pretend we're the victims of Christophobia or Christianophobia. And that's nonsense. As you said, our Lord called us to remember we will suffer, and we should count it all joy. So that's a way of misusing the past. Now, when you come to hate, that's somewhat different. Because you can see that in a postmodern world, people always look at things, truth is dead, God is dead, everything is power. So you look at any situation, race, generation, class, or whatever, and say, who's the oppressor? Who's the oppressed? And then you drive a wedge between the oppressed and the oppressor, and you use words like hate to foment that. So the tragedy is that, take, say, race. From the early days, not Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, mm-hmm. say Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, Martin Luther King, they all tackled the problems of race from a biblical perspective, forgiveness and so on. But starting with Stokely Carmichael, you can see a different way of handling wrongs. Instead of working for confession and repentance and forgiveness and reconciliation, you appeal to resentment and call for reparations and things like this. And the net effect is to widen the gap. And you can see today that since Martin Luther King died, particularly in the last 10 or so years, the race problem has become worse,
yes.
not better. And we need to make sure that the ways we're tackling wrongs really are as deeply biblical as they should be.
You write about how evil and injustice can be contained and to some extent changed in two significant ways. First one is when wrongdoers repent, they can look back later in time at what they have done. And if they repent, they can recast and cancel their motive for the evil done. The deed remains, still remains, but it was done and cannot be undone, but the intent is changed. And then the second is that time helps in another way also. It lends perspective to the deeds of the past and sometimes to the hand of providence that may also become clear. Hindsight often reveals there are silver linings even among the darkest storm clouds.
Well, you think of, say, the words of Joseph to his brothers. And he said, you know, you meant it for evil, the way his brothers had treated him, but God meant it for good. And the silver lining was that God used all that his brothers had done to him. And eventually, the whole of Israel was saved because he rose to be a prince in Egypt and was able to look after his brothers. Or again, the point you mentioned earlier, you take the little phrase, every saint has a past and every sinner has a future. Now, it's not just a little cliche, a truism. That's based on the truth of forgiveness. And you can have someone who's done dreadful things, but when they're forgiven, they're freed from the past and able to open up a future of a second chance, which is incredible. So forgiveness, as I said earlier, you know, is closely tied to freedom. And a biblical view of freedom is one of the most freeing, a biblical view of forgiveness is one of the most freeing things. Whereas in the secular view or the Eastern view, you know, your karma will catch up with you and so on. Not in the biblical view. The burden can be lifted because of God's forgiveness. Well, take the notion of confession. You know, Michel Foucault, a great postmodern thinker, he hated the Christian faith. But he once said the one thing he admired about the Christian faith was confession, a voluntary confession. Because, as he put it, in confession, we're doing something very rare. We're going on record against ourselves. I blew it. I sinned. I committed adultery. I lied. I cheated, I fiddled my income tax returns, whatever it is. When we confess, we go on record against ourselves and clarify what was wrong and then can be forgiven. So there's a profundity of meaning in terms of forgiveness, freedom, time, and the whole biblical way of approaching these things.
And in the distortion of the present, You spend some time writing about the term generation, how it was rooted mostly in biology, and the generation, therefore, was always the time it took for parents to be succeeded by children who had children in their turn. But Jesus refers six times to this generation And he surely meant all those of any age who were his contemporaries, whether young or old. And generations had always included some acknowledgement of culture. But you write that as the world modernized and change speeded up, the term increasingly referred to age cohorts shaped by the same cultural experiences.
Well, this is an incredibly important point because it was once largely biological and now it's more cultural, but it's the change was really driven by consumerism. You know, say when Daimler-Benz created the first great car in Germany, you created a good car, it would last as long as the car lasted. But when Detroit came in and Henry Ford and others wanted to sell cars, you had the model of the year. Why? There wasn't all that much new, but you wanted to sell a new one. And you can think of the turnover in generations now. They're getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And one of the effects of this is what we talked about earlier about progressivism. You always want to be up to date with the latest thing. You know, so I think of a book on the millennials. They were a Copernican generation. And now they're yesterday's generation. We're talking about Generation Z.
Right.
Now, the gospel is relevant in a very profound way. It speaks to all human beings, and it speaks in all generations and time. And Americans have got to look at this segmenting of generations. One of the reasons why it's so dangerous is that it stops the sense of transmission.
Yes.
You know, every generation is a pulse beat in the story of humanity. And there should be a handing on, father to son, mother to daughter, generation to generation. And now the generations are so discreet, so cut off, so independent, that they're losing touch with each other. So both faith and freedom require transmission. So you look, say, the polling on Generation Z. They don't have a very good record on knowing what the faith is, and they don't have a very good record on knowing what the American experiment is. And the simple fact is, with a breakdown of civic education and Christian education and catechism, we have shortchanged the next generation, and transmission has broken down. And both the church and America as a republic are suffering because of that.
And you write, put these, let me go here. The past, the present, and the future, you write, are one and indivisible. So the generationalism that privileges the present at the expense of the past and the future is a disaster for the church. Obsessed with their preoccupation with the present, many modern Christians suffer from chronic myopia. But in their short-sightedness, they not only forget the past, they also render themselves unprepared for the future, and they lose their hold on the deeper calling in the present. Which brings us then to distorting the future, the third current distortion of time, which you write centers on the various forms of progressivism, and that a belief that means that somehow the newer must be the truer and the latest must be the greatest. So you talked a little bit about religious progressivism and revisionism.
Yeah. No, I mentioned that one earlier in the first hour, but take the other one we mentioned, the place of the past. Because if you look in the Bible, two things come again and again and again. One, remember. Two, do not forget. And you look at the younger generation, or many Americans today, they have no interest in history at all. But the fact is, if you take our own little lives, our past, the way we've grown up, who we've come to be, is the secret to our identity today. You can't have identity without knowing your history and your past. And that's true of America, and that's true of the church. And people who've just cut off history are absolutely foolish. Sadly, there was a pastor down the South last year who said that we need to unhitch our faith from the Old Testament, which is really absolutely crazy, because Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. And many of the great truths he fulfills are there in the book of Exodus. Say, human dignity in Genesis, freedom in Exodus. Unless we understand these things and remember and remember and remember, we'll be myopic and cut off in our own generation and be people with an identity crisis.
And so you're right, our modern view of relevance has been badly skewed because, once again, our modern fascination with the future is itself the bastard child of the clock culture. This is where we began, that is at the heart of the modern world. We take our modern view of time as natural and self-evident, but it isn't. And then the final chapter is the end is not the end. And you point out that how all across the world, the dominant emotion in the global era is fear. And from the beginning, go ahead.
No, I love that one, which I learned from Reinhold Niebuhr, the end is not the end. In other words, in the Bible, in the Christian faith, there are two meanings of the word end. You can say end as ending, full stop, period, conclusion. In other words, the Latin word finis, ending. And there are endings in life. All of us are going to die. The day ends. You know, empires never last. They end. There's a lot of things in life that end. That's one meaning of the word. The other meaning is closer to the Greek word telos. End as end in your purpose, your goal, your end in sight. And in any moment in history, there will be endings in the first sense, but they're not endings in the second sense, because God is working out his purposes in history. And one day, the apocalypse will mean the grand unveiling of God's purposes at the end of history. And so followers of Jesus should never be depressed or gloomy or pessimist. No, we're people of hope, however dark the hour is, because the end is not the end. God's purposes are working their way out, even in the crises and catastrophes around us in the immediate moment.
Our guest this evening has been Os Guinness. We've been talking about his book, Carpe Diem, Redeemed. Os, I always come away inspired so much by talking with you. So thank you so much for spending this time with us this evening, and God's blessings to you and your loved ones on both Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to be with you, and I love the way you take books so seriously. I wish everyone did. Thank you.
I hope
God
bless
you.
I hope they take this book seriously, too. Thanks. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
There are a lot of things that we could talk about yet. Let me, a final words from the book. He writes, at the end of the time, there will be an end that rescues and redeems the past, reversing all previous endings and ushering in a future that to the present is as yet unimaginable. Doubtless, our prayers until then will be more urgent and heartfelt at certain times than others. But always our sense of time past and time present will climax in our anticipation of time future. There is no time to be wasted in endless excusing of the past or idle speculations about the future and the legacy of our lives. Seizing the day, that's Carpus Diem, we look back to the first coming of our Lord, and we then raise our glasses to his second coming and return of our King from over the water of time. Come, Lord Jesus, come. So our little lives, he writes, may be incomplete. Our greatest visions may be unfulfilled. Our best actions may be seem no more than small and inconsequential. But for people of faith who are visionary dreamers of the day, our actions into time will always look beyond the horizon of our history to the great day when the widespread ruins of all recurring versions of the sin of man will be eclipsed by the splendor of the city of God. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer.
You bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
In a world of endless notifications, there could be an important one you're missing. Your kidneys may be signaling an SOS. With high blood pressure or type 2 diabetes, your kidneys could be warning you of early signs of damage, which may put you at higher risk for events like heart attack or stroke. But there's a simple test that can help spot a hidden signal. Ask your doctor about a urine test called UACR to help detect kidney disease and heart risk early. To learn more, visit detectthesos.com today.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Did you know your credit card points and miles can lose value to inflation? Credit card companies often reduce the redemption value of your points and miles. Now, imagine a credit card with rewards that can grow in value. With the Gemini credit card, you can earn Bitcoin or one of over 50 other cryptos instantly with no annual fee. Every swipe at the store or gas pump earns you instant rewards deposited straight to your account. Plus, sign up now for a $200 Bitcoin bonus to kickstart your rewards. Visit Gemini.com/card today. Check out the link in the description for more information on rates and fees. Again, if you're looking to invest in Bitcoin but don't know where to start, the Gemini credit card makes it easy.
The Gemini credit card is issued by WebBank. In order to qualify for the $200 crypto intro bonus, you must spend $3,000 in your first 90 days. Terms apply. Some exclusions apply to instant rewards in which rewards are deposited when the transaction posts. This content is not investment advice, and trading crypto involves risk. For more details on rates, fees, and other cost information, see rates and fees. The Gemini credit card may not be used to make gambling-related purchases.